Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio show. My guest for this morning is Dr. Carolyn Roy Bornstein. She is the co-author of Chicken Soup for the Soul, Recovering from Traumatic Brain Injuries. Dr. Bornstein will be sharing inspiring and encouraging stories, including her personal experience, to help uplift and encourage others in their healing journey. Good morning, Dr. Bornstein. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
I'm great, Johnny. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. I'm very excited to talk about Chicken Soup's latest edition, Recovering from Traumatic Brain Injuries. It is a wonderful book. The stories are very compelling and inspirational, and I have to say that the book is a must-read for everyone seeking a better understanding about brain injuries. So congratulations on your work.
Well, thank you so much, and I'm glad you recognize that it's a book for everyone, not just people experiencing traumatic brain injuries or taking care of people with TBIs, but just for the general public to really enhance their understanding of what can be a very complicated injury.
So true, so true. Let us start by getting to know you a little bit better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Sure. I would say that pretty early on, I knew that I wanted to work with children. From a very young age, I babysat for children. I volunteered as a tutor in school for children. And how I ultimately decided to work with children is by becoming a nurse. I was a nurse for 10 years. I worked in the nursery. I worked in children's burn units. I worked on pediatric intensive care units. And from there, I loved my work as a nurse. I loved that intimate, hands-on caring that nurses do. But I ultimately looked at my medical colleagues, the doctors that I worked with, and I was really drawn to the intellectual curiosity, the medical mystery, the diagnostic dilemma. Like, what would we do if a child presented with symptoms and we didn't know what the symptoms indicated? How would we go about approaching that child? So I went to medical school. I had my own two boys at that point. My boys were 6 and 8 when I finished medical school and residency. And I worked for about 15 years in an urban community health center, a very big 70-doctor enterprise. And then about 6 years ago, I and a colleague of mine decided that we wanted a more intimate experience for our patients. We wanted our patients to have greater access to us. We wanted greater access to our patients. And so we started our own private practice where it's just us two doctors, and we even do home visits for some of our newborn babies. We don't cover with other pediatric practices. We don't have nurse practitioners. It's really just us with kind of an old-fashioned practice. And although my boys are grown now, my sons are 31 and 29 and off on their own, our new life experience has been taking in two amazing, wonderful teenage foster daughters.
That's fantastic. I don't even know the home visit by doctor still exists anymore.
Yeah, no, it's very rare. It's very unusual, but we love it. It gives us a little bird's eye view into our patients' worlds.
Interesting. I know you mentioned about the fact that at an early age you have this sort of liking or the inclination to be in the healthcare industry and pretty much in the service of people, I would think. Were there role models for you that sort of inched you toward that career, that somehow you were led to in a way you were looking up at someone within your family or someone that you kind of really look up to?
Well, interestingly, there was a doctor. His name is Jerry Durbin. He's still at the University of Massachusetts Medical Center. And when I was applying to medical school, you have to understand I was married. I had two young children. And a lot of the feedback I got was not positive. I got a lot of, what are you, crazy? You know, what? You have two little kids and you go to medical school? Are you nuts? But Jerry was always very encouraging, and I could talk to him about individual patients. I could ask him any question. His door was always open. He was a family man himself, so he understood that sort of balance between work and family. He was and still is a great role model for me.
Fantastic. How did the partnership with Chicken Soup resulting in recovering from traumatic brain injuries come about?
Well, Johnny, I have to say that partnership began with my own traumatic brain injury experience with my son. My son, Neil, this is over 10 years ago now, I'm going back. He was 17 at the time. He was dating a young woman named Trista, who was 15, and they were walking her home from a study date at our house when I got the call every parent dreads. And I learned that those two children had been hit from behind by a teenage drunk hit-and-run driver. And his girlfriend, Trista, did not survive her injuries, and Neil was left with a serious traumatic brain injury. So as you can imagine, for the first several years after that injury, I really had all I could do just to help my son recover. He was in the intensive care unit, then the step-down unit. Then I spent months driving him to physical therapy, managing his anti-seizure medications, going to school meetings, advocating for academic accommodations for him due to his memory loss and cognitive effects. And it took years for me to really reflect on this experience and sort of process what had happened to our family. And about 5 years after his injury, I started work on a memoir that was published in 2012 called Crash, A Mother, A Son, and the Journey from Grief to Gratitude. And that writing that book and telling that story was very helpful and therapeutic for me. And although it didn't feel it at the time, in fact, it felt like I was kicking scabs off old wounds day after day when I was actually writing the book. But in retrospect, it was really helpful. And so I became a writer as a result of this experience. I wrote a story for a Chicken Soup for the Soul collection called The Hierarchy of Grief. And in that story, I talk about being the mother of the child who didn't die in the accident and how it took a very long time for me to acknowledge that I had losses to grieve because I felt like I needed to be grateful that my son survived. And so I was familiar with Chicken Soup, and a year or two ago I realized that they had never dedicated a book to traumatic brain injuries. And traumatic brain injuries are so out there. They're so prevalent in our society, in our country. I felt it was really important. So I emailed Amy Newmark, who is my wonderful publisher and co-author of this book, with an idea. And interestingly, Amy at that point, her son's best friend had just sustained a traumatic brain injury of his own. I believe it was a skateboarding or a skiing accident. And his mother, Amy's friend, said that she was reading everything she could find on TBI. And she said, Amy, if there were a Chicken Soup book on TBI, I would buy it. I would read it. And it was probably the next day that my email landed in her inbox, and she was just very open to the idea. It was just this sort of this perfect storm, this constellation of things that were happening in our two personal lives with our commitment to bringing this book to life, because we think it's a very important and helpful book for survivors and their families.
It's a wonderful story, and also I believe today is the release date for the book, if I'm not mistaken.
This is our pub date.
It's a wonderful thing to do, because I believe the last time we launched a book about a month ago, it went out to be one of the top best-selling book on Amazon the next day. So I'm very excited about that.
Well, we can only hope the same for this book.
It is a fantastic book. I really like reading it. It's tough at times to read. One can only imagine the survivors going through what they went through and having the tenacity to actually write about what they experienced. It is a tough read, but then it's a wonderful read at the same time because it's very inspirational, motivational, all together inclusive to help people understand what this individual goes through and what they have to give up. And in so many ways, so much more that they gain after the fact.
That's an interesting theme that came up over and over and over again in this book, that people talk about brain injury as being the worst and the best thing that ever happened to them.
Right.
The worst for obvious reasons, but the best, often they will talk about brain injury as gift, being grateful that it allowed them to meet the people they met, it allowed them to find their purpose in life.
And so true, because no matter what happens with you in life, if you're proactive at it, and if you look for something, the answer is everywhere, and I believe in that. In this particular case, these individuals not only have their life turned around, plus they impacted so many people around them in a positive way.
Yes. And over we read stories of people becoming so inspired that they actually changed careers, became a neurosurgeon in one instance, or getting their PhD specifically to help brain injury patients in another. Very inspiring choices people make.
Well, the timing is right for the book because I'm trying to segue into something a little bit, not necessarily different, but one of the questions I was going to be asking you is, what is the definition of traumatic brain injury? And before you answer that question, recently, obviously, certainly within the last year or so, you hear a lot of concussion that goes with football players who are healthy, who die young. These are athletes that have basically been exposed to brain injuries.
Yes. Yes, this is a huge problem, and this is one that I do a lot of public speaking about, sort of educating my own medical colleagues about the recognition and management of concussion. There's just in 15 to 18-year-old kids, there's 130,000 of these traumatic brain injuries in children each year. So it's a huge problem. And here in Massachusetts and increasingly in states across the country, departments of public health have been instituting new guidelines in high schools that are requiring not just coaches and athletic trainers, but the student athletes themselves and their parents to, number one, recognize the symptoms of concussion, number two, report them to someone. And now it's the coach's responsibility to sit those children out if they even suspect a traumatic brain injury.
Right. People have a tendency, I think, to think about, like in your case, your personal experience. Traumatic brain injuries come from accident, whether it's a fall or an auto accident or whatever that is. But they tend not to focus on the everyday aspects of athletic competition.
Right. And that's a very, very important and large source of these concussions. And as you mentioned, we don't really know at this point what that threshold is. You know, how many concussions have to occur before there's permanent loss of function, you know, before what you're talking about is chronic traumatic encephalopathy. These, you know, boxers and these professional football players who have had, you know, countless concussions. We don't know what that threshold number is, so we're just being cautious in our with our high school athletes and middle school athletes by, you know, changing the mantra from if you can walk, you can play to when in doubt, sit them out.
Right, right, right. Do you have any latest national statistics regarding traumatic brain injuries that you can share with us?
Yes, it's quite a staggering number. In this country alone, every year 1.7 million people sustain a traumatic brain injury. That's a TBI every 18.5 seconds.
Wow.
So it's all around us. There are currently, at this moment, more than 5 million children and adults who are living with permanent disabilities from traumatic brain injury.
Wow. That's astounding. You mentioned about children are getting hurt, and not because of accident, because of being involved in athletics. That's really preventable.
Well, and I don't know if we're going to prevent concussions, but hopefully with these new guidelines, we're going to recognize them and treat them properly with physical rest as well as cognitive rest. We're increasingly realizing the importance of resting the brain after it's been injured. It seems so obvious, but...
Very interesting. Why should people care about traumatic brain injuries?
Well, because... like we just said, it's everywhere. It's out there. The numbers, as you said, are staggering. And it's also, while a severe traumatic brain injury can be very obvious with its motor impairments and speech impairments, a large majority of these survivors of traumatic brain injury really have a largely invisible injury. In fact, the first chapter in our book is titled, "But You Look So Normal."
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's very hard for people to understand these sort of subtle long-term effects on memory, on name and face recognition, on executive function, meaning just planning day-to-day activities. You know, family members may not understand that a TBI survivor is not going to be able to say on July 25th at 7 o'clock, "I'm going to be having a good day, so yes, I'll go to that wedding or shower." They, you know, they often can't plan. There are good days and bad days and ups and downs and triggers and just unexpectedly bad days one day. And I think that's very hard for family members and friends to understand. There's a story in the book about a mother really struggling with her adult daughter's traumatic brain injury from the standpoint of her friends kind of abandoning her. You know, they it's just hard to understand. So I think that's why people should care, just to get a more nuanced understanding of this injury.
Well, the book certainly brings this to the forefront, because a lot of times we tend to recognize physical injuries. But when you talk about the brain, you're right, it is an invisible injury that no one really can tell. And especially there's nothing physically wrong with you.
Right, exactly, in many cases. That's exactly right. That's literally right. You do a CAT scan of someone with a concussion, and it can be perfectly normal. Mm-hmm. But that person or that child can still have a lot of difficulty with memory, with executive function, with sensory overload. You know, noises bother these children. You know, bright lights bother these children. It's a lot of these subtle things that make day-to-day living challenging.
So true. Please share with us about your family stories in the book and your personal connection with traumatic brain injury. I know you shared a little bit about the accident itself, but one of the things that you did in the book, as part of your own realization, coming to terms and healing process for yourself as the caregiver, one of the things that you did was you did a lot of journaling, and that sort of helped to work within yourself in terms of addressing the issue accordingly. I'd rather have you tell the stories, because it's such a wonderful story.
Yes, that's true. I did, while I didn't start writing, becoming a writer for several years after, I was journaling all the way through, and that was helpful to kind of vent on the page, so to speak. Because, you know, as a caregiver, it's really difficult to watch your loved one go through something like this. I did watch Neil lose friends as people just didn't understand this new Neil, this very different personality. You know, his sense of humor changed, subtle things like that. And when you think about it, he suffered memory loss, which I think the obvious thing is, well, that's going to hamper him academically, and he did. He went from a boy who got a perfect 800 on his math SATs to someone who really had to drop all his AP classes and utilize every help available to him in college and still eke out mediocre grades. So you can understand how memory loss impacts him academically. But what might not be as obvious is it really hampered him socially as well. Because you can imagine, he would walk into a room of people in college and think, "Do I know these people? Have I been introduced to them? If I have, where do I know them from? Who introduced us? He really lost a lot of confidence in those years. And that was really hard to look at. And in terms of the personal connection and what I've done with this, I will very candidly share with you that as a physician, as a pediatrician, I was really humbled by all that I did not know and understand about brain injury. And I'll give you an example. I mentioned that he was depressed on antidepressants, seeing a therapist for 5 years after the accident. Well, I thought, well, naturally he's depressed. He lost his girlfriend. His entire world has been upside down. But I didn't realize that traumatic brain injury can cause a real organic depression that's different from and more difficult to treat than your garden variety reactive kind of depression. So I kind of went on a little feeding frenzy, if you will, learning everything I could about traumatic brain injury, like Amy Newmark's friend, the boy with a traumatic brain injury. You get this hunger to learn all you can. And what I've done is to try to take this terrible thing that's happened to our family and make something good come of it. And part of that, I think, happens when we tell our stories. I think this book is something good that came of it, because it certainly was helpful for me to tell my story, and I can only hope that it was helpful for all of our writers and contributors to tell their stories as well.
It certainly is a wonderful book. In keeping with Chicken Soup's concept of 101 stories, I have selected several stories from the book as talking points for this morning. Can you please give us a short rundown of these wonderful stories? The first chapter itself, "But You Look So Normal." And this story is very interesting, "As I Am Now" by Jan Abbas DeLong.
Yes, this first story is called "As I Am Now." And we talked about there are many ways to sustain a traumatic brain injury. And Jen sustained her brain injury by falling on ice. And her story illustrates a couple of things. One theme that has come up in multiple stories is this idea of delayed diagnosis. She fell on ice, and she hurt her arm, and she went to the emergency room, and the focus was on the arm. They x-rayed it, they put it in a sling, and they sent her home. And nobody asked her about her head, and she didn't complain of any head injury at that time. But the next morning, she woke up with an excruciating headache. She gradually realized that she was having problems with her vision, with her balance, with these executive function processes we talked about, with multitasking and organization and prioritizing. And she realized she had a brain injury, and she had to seek help for herself. And I hear that as I speak to brain injury associations. I hear that over and over. People who are in the hospital with multiple trauma, they're focused on their legs and their arms and getting physical therapy for those kinds of things, and never really even realize that they have a brain injury. And it takes the person themselves, when they go home, to realize they're not themselves. And the title of her story, "As I Am Now," comes from some advice she gets from a colleague. Do you mind if I read a couple lines of that?
Not at all. I would love for you to read those lines.
So a colleague said to her at a conference once, "May you experience joy as you are now. May you have peace within yourself as you are now. May you show kindness to yourself as you are now. May you seek the goodness in yourself as you are now. May you show gentleness to yourself as you are now."
Those are powerful words, and basically in a sense, in a way, enjoy the present moment. You can't change
exactly
the past. It's very powerful, very, very powerful, and I'm glad you read some of those wonderful words, and there are plenty more. These are the things that I believe the book could be so helpful to people.
Yes, yes. And also helpful to, you know, not just you don't have to have a traumatic brain injury to get the inspiration and advice and practical information from these stories. They can apply to any adversity, any struggle, any obstacle that people are experiencing in their lives.
So true. The next chapter is self-discovery, and the story is Starting Over by Celeste Palmer.
Yes. Celeste Palmer was one of these people who was in a very high-power job. She was a consultant in a very challenging field of accounting and database management when her world was turned upside down by a motor vehicle accident. And she went from being this high-power businesswoman to finding herself having difficulty with day-to-day activities. She tells the story in her piece about trying to bake cookies one day, and she burned the cookies because when her kitchen timer went off, she was so proud of herself that she had set her kitchen timer, but it went off in her pocket when she was standing at the post office. She had simply forgotten that she was baking cookies. And she goes on to detail some of her challenges. Her motor skills were impaired. She still suffers physically in pain and has physical therapy and chiropractic and massage and so forth. But that did not stop her from, even though she couldn't return to her field of accounting, she still went back to school and got a certificate in leadership. And Celeste ended up founding a nonprofit organization that provides resources for survivors of TBI like herself. And her motto she shares with us at the end of the story is believe, be patient, and never give up.
So true. And that mantra, that motto applies in just about everything in every one of us.
Right. And there's this other mantra that you'll hear people with TBI talk about. It's not a sprint, it's a marathon, that idea of patience. And I will tell you, as a physician, as you can imagine, I go to a lot of brain injury conferences. And
sure.
Two in particular I went to this past year, both tried to kind of blow out of the water this idea that we've had for a long time that whatever gains people with TBIs are going to make, they're going to make them in the first year or two. Well, we're finding that that's not true, that there are gains to be made years after brain injury, maybe even always.
Right, right. I would think so, because I would think the first 2 years is so much healing that you can't possibly comprehend everything. And to me, I believe in building or healing in layers.
Exactly, in layers and over time. It takes a lot of patience. Lee Woodruff, in the foreword to the book, talks about being a type A personality who just had to stop and learn patience, that recovery is slow. But it's there. It's progress.
Right, right. The next chapter is Never Giving Up, which, of course, a wonderful chapter that follows what we just talked about, Healing Your Heart After a Brain Injury by Barbara Webster. This is a wonderful story.
It is a wonderful story, and Barbara Webster is a wonderful person who I happen to know through my volunteer work at the Brain Injury Association of Massachusetts. Barbara, again, sustained her traumatic brain injury with a motor vehicle accident. Again, while she did black out briefly at the accident, her brain injury was not diagnosed initially. She was sent home from the emergency room with Advil. And just began to realize, why am I so exhausted? Why can I barely eat or barely talk? Why is it taking such effort to do things mentally that I would easily do? Barbara was a bank officer, and she writes that she literally could not hold two and two in her head long enough to get to four. She writes about living in the town she lived in for 20 years, and now she couldn't find her way around. And she talks about this truly existential crisis she went through, this fundamental life crisis of who am I? You know, who am I? If I'm a bank officer and I can't do my job, you know, if my friends aren't my friends, if I am a problem for my family, who am I, you know? And she just reached out to spiritual guides, and one thing she realized is that she had some grieving to do, some grief work to grieve for the person that she no longer was. And this is a overarching theme in a lot of our stories that we received. People even talk about the old me dying in that accident and the new me being born. And I think that's one of Barbara's points, is that's when the healing can begin, is when you realize you're not going to go backwards to what you used to be, but there's plenty of future for you to move forward. And that's what she did. She started volunteering for the Brain Injury Association. She started a support group for people in her area of Massachusetts. And ultimately, she became an employee of the BIA. She manages their survivor support group network. So this idea of reinvention, also, we kind of hear these stories over and over again. And the quote that I chose for her story is by Bernie Siegel, the retired pediatric surgeon who wrote Love, Medicine, and Miracles. And he says, we are human beings, not human doings. And I think that's what Barbara is trying to say. We are more than our jobs. We are the totality of our hearts and minds and souls.
It's a beautiful quote. Next is healing powers of Mother Nature. And again, it's pretty much in line with the things we talked about from the very beginning. Are we paying attention to the present moment? This particular story is just wonderful. Finding Hidden Messages of Hope by Dr. Christine Durham.
Yes, Christine Durham is a really wonderful writer. This is a very wonderful story. And the reason we included it in the chapter on Mother Nature, in this chapter are a lot of stories. People find healing in the outdoors, in, you know, climbing a mountain, in, you know, feeling the water of the ocean, in seeing a sunrise. And Christine, in her story, talks about flowers, and specifically daffodils, as a metaphor for healing. She had planted daffodils as the old me, as she says, and then she sustained this traumatic brain injury in a car accident and goes through her rehabilitation. She has balance issues. She walks with a cane. She has double vision. She has to wear an eye patch to correct her double vision. And she comes home to these flowers that are blooming. And she just has this sort of epiphany where she says, I was swamped with sadness that the woman who had planted those bulbs, the old me, was not the same woman who now viewed the golden blooms, the new me. But the miracle that those scruffy brown bulbs could be transformed into beautiful yellow trumpets was the proof of the power of nature. And I think it said a lot about her healing. She's also a very beautiful writer. She starts the story. Christine was a philosophy professor in Australia. And she starts the story. She's walking across a stage to give a keynote speech and receive an award from her university celebrating the 110th anniversary. And she is flashing back to 20 years ago, walking in that same classroom with her cane and her eye patch, and having a student come up to her and take the chalk from her hand at the board and say, she wasn't Dr. Durham then, but Mrs. Durham, let me write that word for you. You know you can't spell anymore. And just reflecting on how far she has actually come, and what Christine did to earned the doctor in her name, is she went back and she got a PhD specifically to help brain injury patients. And it was one of her patients who said to her, brain injury is both the worst and the best thing that's ever happened to me. And Christine concurred.
Yeah. It's a very powerful story in the sense that God knows how many people she motivated by just being who she is and the actions she took after the fact.
Right, and I'm sure she motivated countless people in her personal life who personally know her and touch her, and I think her story will also inspire and motivate and touch our readers who read her words.
So true. The next chapter is Acceptance I chose this because I'm a ballroom dancer, so I like the fact that it just drew me. Wow, okay, that's a story about dance. So I have to talk about that. The article is The Dance by Helen Reed Stewart.
Yes, Helen Stewart was a nurse, and she sustained her brain injury. We spoke about how there were so many ways to sustain a brain injury. Mm-hmm. She actually bumped her head on a door jamb and sustained a traumatic brain injury. But she was a nurse. She was also a very passionate contra dancer.
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about how for a good year or two after her injury, she didn't even think about contra dancing. This thing that was so much a passion and such a source of joy for her just was completely off her radar. And about a year after she sustained her traumatic brain injury, she decided to try it. And when she went there, just watching the other people dance made her dizzy.
Mm-hmm.
The noises, the sounds of the music, it was too loud. She just left feeling completely defeated, feeling, I'll never do this. But then a couple months later, she went back, and she did one dance. And she did it. She said, okay, that's enough. I'm going to go home. And so she has these, it's not advice exactly, but she shares with us what worked for her, what enabled her to finally relearn this passion of hers. And I would say, too, one lesson in all this is that, you know, think about what used to give you joy in your life and go for it. Try to bring in as much of that as you can. And she shared that, you know, a rested brain was essential. So on nights that she was going to contra dance, she took a nap. Simple.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, had to understand and realize that you don't have to dance every dance. You know, you can pace yourself. You
right.
can take breaks. Simple things like just keeping hydrated. And, you know, I think that those, you know, we're not all contra dancers, but we all
right.
have things that we used to be able to do that maybe we want to relearn and get back to. And I think that advice, you know, keeping rested, taking breaks, pacing yourself, understanding you don't have to do it all, taking baby steps, those are all, you know, information and advice that can be applied to any activity that we're trying to relearn. And the other neat thing about this story I thought was kind of interesting is
mm-hmm.
that she shares this story. She's at this contra dance, and she's watching the other dancers. And one woman in particular, her name is Jen, she notices she's a good dancer. She's an accurate dancer. Her feet are doing what they're supposed to do. But there isn't the sense of joy and abandonment and that you see in other faces of contra dancers. And she's
yes.
really concentrating on her feet, on her what she's doing. And so Helen thinks to herself, I bet this is another TBI survivor. And she goes up and she introduces herself, and sure enough, Jen, she has her story about her own TBI. So I think there's this connection that people with shared experiences have that allows them to recognize each other and share their stories and support each other, which is a beautiful part of the story.
It's a beautiful story, and the other reason I chose this story is because people don't realize that dancing is really a wonderful exercise to reconnect your brain neurons. My dance partner and I are actually teaching two classes a month at a senior living center here in Dallas. We find wonderful support from the social director as well as the residents because they are very excited about learning and moving around the floor, being engaged in all the motor skills. So dancing
yes,
is definitely a wonderful recovery process for any brain injury, I would think.
Yeah, I would think so. Not to mention just that fellowship with other human beings and just
that's
bringing
correct.
All the joy into your life that you can. Joy is healing.
Right, right. The next chapter is Attitude is Everything, and I love this story. How I Learned to Walk by Mike Strand.
Yeah, this is a really sweet, interesting, inspiring story. Mike Strand was 25 years old, and the way he describes it, he was sitting on top of the world. He had a great job in a factory. It was a good job for him. He had just proposed to his high school sweetheart, and luck of luck, she said yes. So life was good. Then he was in a car accident, and he suffered a traumatic brain injury. He was 10 days in a coma. And as he describes it, when he came out of the coma, he said, I could barely walk and barely talk. So he has to learn to do these things all over again, as so many of the writers and so many TBI survivors have to do. Well, a few days into his stay in the hospital, his fiancée, Linda, comes to visit him, and she asks him, do you still want to go through with the wedding? And he's beside himself with joy. Here's the love of his life, and here he is. He can barely walk. He can barely talk. And she wants to stay with him. And so he uses that as his motivation to learn to walk. And he describes, in fact, his first session in physical therapy. And his physical therapist, step by step, inch by inch, telling him what to do, lean your weight on your left foot, pick up your right foot, mm-hmm. put down your right foot, lean your weight on your right foot. I mean, a lot of lifting and stumbling goes along with this. He's got two physical therapists on either side of him. And while on the outside they're saying, lift up your left foot, lift up your right foot, every step that he takes in his mind, he's saying, I love you, Linda. I love you, Linda. I love you, Linda. And he makes it his goal, his motivation, to complete his physical therapy, to walk his bride down the aisle. Mm-hmm. And I just thought it was a beautiful, the name of the chapter is Attitude is Everything, and a beautiful example of someone finding something in their life to motivate them and to keep them going, to encourage them, setting goals for yourself, all these life lessons.
So true. Love can conquer a lot of things. The next one is another wonderful love story. That's what I consider it, anyway. Coping strategies that work. And the story is Love in the Right Places by Pete Daigle. See, we guys are romantic too, you know.
Yep, there are a lot of male contributors. You're absolutely right, Johnny. Yeah, and the coping strategy that Pete is referring to is mindfulness and meditation. That's what he has found help him. But the story you mentioned, love, mm-hmm. that he tells is a story. I don't think we learn how he sustained his brain injury, but he has a brain injury. And one day he does what a lot of brain injury patients do or survivors do. He has taken his car in for repairs, and he suddenly realizes he has a doctor's appointment and he has no car and no way to get there. So he hitchhikes to his doctor's appointment, and a woman picks him up. And this, the way he describes this meeting, kind of reminds me of the story a couple stories ago with Helen and Jen, the dancers, kind of recognizing each other. Mm-hmm. Pete writes, since my brain injury, I have noticed that I feel people and their energy in a more spiritual and creative way. So in other words, he really connected with this woman. So the woman drives him to his doctor's appointment, and they exchange phone numbers. And like many brain-injured survivors, he forgets that he has her phone number. But she doesn't forget. And eventually they get together, and they realize they love each other, and they do what many lovers do and try to live together. And he talks about the big picture. And he talks about how most people kind of look at the big picture and see these big connections, and that he can't do that. He talks about, in fact, as just a survival skill, compartmentalizing his life. And he talks about putting things in boxes. And he means that literally and figuratively. Literally, just to be organized and to know where everything is. You'll meet TBI survivors in this book who have to put every credit card in its exact place in their purse so that they know they don't have to expend a lot of mental energy wondering where it is, thinking about where it is, trying to remember where it is. So he uses boxes as a metaphor for compartmentalizing his life as a way to move through his day, and how ultimately that didn't work with this woman who wanted more big picture and more spontaneity in her life. And he writes at the end of his story, people with TBI may need to think inside the boxes to maintain emotional health and even love at times. And those who love us may need to learn to think outside of them.
Right.
So it is a beautiful story.
Yes, definitely. The next chapter is on Opportunity Knocks. And the story is Accidental Destiny by Cecile Proctor.
Cecile. Yeah, she. I think she used the title of this story both literally and figuratively, Accidental Destiny, referring to her mother's car accident where she sustained a brain injury. And Accidental Destiny, figuratively meaning she found herself pursuing a life goal that she actually never really set out to do. The story opens with Cecile working at a restaurant. She's a manager at a restaurant, busy, you know, successful restaurant. And she's actually working when she gets the call that her mother's been hit by a car. And she gets the call from her father. Then she goes on to talk about, you know, watching her mother recover. You know, her mother's changed personality, and she becomes really fascinated with the brain as just an amazing organ. And she did what I did, kind of learn everything she could about brain injuries. And she sort of had this epiphany that she wanted to go to college. And she, at the time she wrote this story, she was in her third year of college, majoring in psychology and minoring in cognitive neuroscience. And she also is, she's from Canada, and she's her area's contact for the Brain Injury Association of Canada. So it's a really inspirational story about someone, again, taking an obstacle and turning it into an opportunity, taking a negative situation and turning it into something positive, both for herself and her family and for others.
Certainly. She's trying to make the difference. That leads us to the very last chapter, titled Making a Difference, Living a Life of Purpose After Brain Injury by David Grant.
Yes, David Grant is a writer, and he was a writer at the time. He was also an avid bicyclist. And he was avidly cycling one day. He lives in my neck of the woods in southern New Hampshire when he was hit by a teenager in a car and sustained a traumatic brain injury in a cycling accident. And he, like many TBI survivors, took, you know, a year just to get their legs under them, literally and figuratively. But then in the second year after his brain injury, he did something quite amazing. He wrote a memoir called Metamorphosis, just detailing his experience as a TBI survivor. And he talks about some of the late effects of traumatic brain injury that he has, for example, disinhibition. People with traumatic brain injuries are often disinhibited. But he sees that as a gift because it allows him to make friends easily, as he says. He's a very, very positive person. And he also talks about people with traumatic brain injuries often have speech and voice impairments, both word finding and also quality of your voice. And he said that that didn't happen to him, that he has a clear voice. And he decided that he was going to use that clear voice to speak to and to become an advocate for traumatic brain injury. And David is one of the people who talks about the old David dying and the new David being born. He said, a new person was living in my old body. and he's become a very busy advocate for traumatic brain injury. He writes blogs and columns for several brain injury publications, and he does a lot of public speaking in brain injury associations. And if I may, I'll close the
sure.
stories with how he closed his story. And it's a prayer of St. Francis that he adapts to TBI. He writes, "One of my favorite prayers is the prayer of St. Francis. In this powerful prayer, St. Francis says, it is better to forgive than to be forgiven. It is in giving that we receive. I have adapted one line of this prayer since my injury. It is in healing that we are healed." So David started a support group in his area in New Hampshire for other TBI survivors, and he shares the story of him helping his fellow survivors heal helps him heal as well.
Mm-hmm. So true. These are individuals that have somehow realized that, hey, I have to do something positive with what has happened to me. And in so many ways, what they did, they helped someone else and affected so many lives. In your case, what you went through on a personal experience, and you decided to connect with others. And that's truly amazing.
Well, I think that also happened. Lee Woodruff, as many of your listeners will recognize that name, did exactly the same thing. Her husband, Bob Woodruff, is the ABC news correspondent who suffered a traumatic brain injury when he was embedded with our troops in Iraq in 2006. And they went through that very profound, scary experience. And they came out the other side of that really wanting to do something for our military families. And they founded the Bob Woodruff Foundation, which hopes to help our returning soldiers and their families as they return to life in the United States and help them with their transition. They find local projects, they fund local projects, they raise money and raise awareness for these issues. And what your listeners should know is that a portion of the proceeds from this new Chicken Soup for the Soul collection is going to the Bob Woodruff Foundation, which we're very proud of.
I'm very proud that you guys are doing this. This is just fantastic work on everyone's part. What are some of the key tips you can share with caregivers to help them?
Well, with caregivers, one of the people in the book wrote something that really resonated with me. Caregivers are survivors, too.
Right.
So I would say take care of yourself. I mean, as a doctor, I give that advice to my new moms of newborns. You got to rest. You got to eat. You know, you're not going to be good to others if you can't be good to yourself. And then other things we've touched on a little bit, how TBI can be a really invisible injury. So that annoying person in the grocery store with their cart taking up half the aisle and they're taking up the other half, looking at their cans of soup and their coupons and their list, well, that person might have a TBI. You know, so just to be a little bit more aware, a little bit more patient. And to respect people's feelings of loss. They're not going to be who they were before. They're not going to be able to attain things that they maybe thought they would in life, and to acknowledge that grieving process.
I would think that should be also support groups for caregivers, someone that especially a close family like you in this case, because the feeling of helplessness, not being able to do much, I would think you have gone through that process yourself.
Yes, and I think a lot of caregivers will get a lot out of this book, because the stories in this book are written not just by survivors, but there are lots of stories by caregivers, stories by mothers and stories by daughters, and there are stories by professionals. There are stories by occupational therapists and art therapists and neurorehabilitation physicians, myself as a pediatrician. So there's a lot of support, advice, and inspiration in these stories.
Wonderful. Do you have any advice for someone who is recently diagnosed with traumatic brain injury?
Well, I would say one thing is to take predictions with a grain of salt. And I mean that both the positive and the negative predictions, because it's really impossible to predict how much recovery someone will achieve. In our case, our son, we were told, Neil's going to be just fine. And that was not our experience at all.
Yeah.
Our experience was he needed a lot of help and support after this brain injury. And I speak to many, many TBI survivors who were given dire prognoses. You know, he'll never talk again. He'll never walk again. And then I'm hearing stories about, he's walking, he's talking, he graduated from college. You know, so recovery can be ongoing. So just to, you know, in the words of one of my audience members recently, never underestimate a survivor. You know, we talked about it's not a sprint, it's a marathon, you know, really recognizing that recovery is a long, ongoing process.
Do you have any advice for families and friends?
I would say patience and acceptance and reaching out. I heard from a lot of TBI survivors that it can be a very isolating experience. People don't know how to react, how to respond, whether it's, you know, someone whose speech is impaired and it's literally difficult to understand them, or if it's just that they have subtle personality changes and you don't understand this new person. I would say try, reach out, be there.
By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, would you like to share a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Yeah, I promote and believe in taking experiences that are challenges and obstacles and turning those into opportunities. I, in my own small way, in my own little corner of Massachusetts here, speak to high school students during prom season. This past May was a very busy season for me, about the dangers of underage drinking and drunk driving. I speak to college students in the fall during Alcohol Awareness Week, just trying to take this drunk driving accident that my son suffered through and trying to turn it into something positive.
That's wonderful. That's a wonderful recipe for living life. How has putting together recovering from traumatic brain injuries impacted you personally?
I would say powerfully. I would say profoundly. And I actually wrote a story for the collection that was about exactly that, how I know that writing my story was cathartic, was therapeutic ultimately, and helped me a lot. And I wished with all my heart that I could include all of the hundreds and hundreds of stories that we got. It was really painful and difficult, actually, deeply, to have to choose from amongst all these wonderful stories. But I hope that in writing these stories, even if your story wasn't chosen for the collection, that it was helpful, because I believe in the power of narrative. I believe that is how we connect as human beings, by telling each other our stories, and that's how we heal from traumatic experiences, by sharing those stories with others.
So true. That is actually a wonderful recipe for living life, too, because it's a process of transference in getting it out of ourselves to help others.
That's true. Yes, sharing stories is powerful.
So true. Dr. Bonson, thank you for the great recipes, I would say recipes here in plural, of living, and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Sue Gowdy. Sue is an inspirational speaker and author. Sue and I will be discussing her latest book, The Journey from Fear to Love is Shorter Than You Think. This poignant memoir reveals how our earliest experiences program the character of our health, relationships, and ability to achieve our desires. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to fmmktalkradio.com. Thank you for listening, and have a blessed week. Dr. Bornstein, it has been a pleasure. Thank you again, and have a blessed day.
Thank you. The pleasure was mine.
Thank you. Bye-bye.